For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
To our political debates and panels day. Thrilled to have you here. We're going to get it started quick with this first debate between Destiny and Infrared. And with that, thank you very much, gentlemen, for being here. The floor is all yours, Destiny, for your quick opening. And then Infrared will follow with his quick opening. And then we'll jump right into open conversation. Thanks so much, Destiny. The floor is all yours.
For only being in office for 1 year, I think Biden has some pretty good legislative accomplishments behind him, and what he's been able to do as president through executive action and through his guidance as a leader, I think has been more successful than most would have thought. I think the second round of stimulus, the child tax credit that cut childhood poverty in half, meeting and beating his expectations for the amount of vaccines that he wanted in the population, and then getting the infrastructure bill passed, I think the largest infrastructure bill passed in the history of U.S. legislation, I think have all been pretty big achievements for Biden's current agenda. I think there are some problems that are going on right now, but people like to blame wider economic problems on the president that he can't exert much control over. But all in all, I think for the first year, I think Biden's had a really successful year in office.
So when evaluating the performance of a president, to me, the standard to which we should hold them is not the alternative president that could have been elected before they were in office, but their decisiveness, their boldness, and their ability to make decisions that are proportionate to the crisis facing the country. So in that regard, I don't want to compare Biden and evaluate his performance by just saying what would Trump would have done or what would an alternative president do. I think the question is how have other presidents in the history of this country responded to their respective crisis facing the country? How have they exercised the decisive and bold leadership befitting of the office? FDR with his New Deal, Eisenhower with his national highway system, JFK with the moon landing, Lyndon Johnson with his Great Society, et cetera, et cetera. Has Biden been able to exercise a comparable level of leadership to these presidents in the midst of not only similar but far more overreaching crisis?
It's hard to compare. I guess when I'm trying to evaluate the successfulness of a president, I'm seeing what are his goals and then has he accomplished those goals as best as he can. Whether or not any individual president will on his own live up to the highest and best qualities of every president prior, and then if we were to try to guess what those presidents do in today's society, I think is a little bit misguided. FDR had massive margins in the House and the Senate. So to compare anything FDR does to Biden, who is sitting on a 50-50 vote split in the Senate, I think doesn't really hit the mark. In terms of decisive and bold decisions, I mean, we could talk about actually committing to the withdrawal of Afghanistan, something that a lot of people thought wouldn't happen and would get kicked down the road again. But I think Biden went ahead and he pulled the trigger on that, which I would say was both decisive and bold. I guess... what I'd be looking for is what area right now in Biden's administration, realistically, could he have made a better decision than he has made? And is it realistic that we would have expected him to make said decision?
In regards to FDR, He had massive margins in the House and Senate, but the question you have to ask is why? FDR himself was actually facing resistance from conservative Democrats, and yet, in contrast to Joe Biden, FDR pursued a vigorous campaign to basically, in a way not too dissimilar from Trump, force those Democrats to fall in line with his agenda. He didn't say that we're scared we're going to lose the they're going to lose to Republicans, so we have to be conciliatory towards them. One of the reasons FDR was had all the margins that he did was because he was an authentically popular president. And people were scared to go against his agenda because it was so popular among the Democratic constituency across the board. In regards to Afghanistan, I agree that it probably is the only, in my view, good thing Biden has done in terms of foreign policy throughout his administration. But his intentions are questionable, to say the least. I'm not sure how bold and decisive this decision is in lieu of the geopolitical situation. Would it have been inevitable regardless? Who knows? As far as decisions Biden could have made that he doesn't make, one has to take a broad perspective and ask, for all of the things that Biden is, all of the obstacles he's facing within his own party, why is Biden unable to exercise the necessary leadership to make Democrats like Joe Manchin and Sinema fall in line? Other presidents have been able to do this. Even Trump was able to do this. Because I agree that Biden has a lot of things he wants to do on his agenda, like the Build Back Better program, but we agree he's not able to do it. He's not able to exercise or fulfill his campaign promises, and he's conveniently able to blame this 50-50 split.
I'm going to aim for shorter responses, and we'll try to drill down on a few of these. So when we talk about FDR and we say, well, he didn't have to be, why is Biden so conciliatory? The implication here is that Biden is making a mistake by moving more towards the center to try to bring together the left and right to pass legislation. Now, I would argue that the infrastructure bill passing with some 15 Senate votes of Republicans is an example of that being successful. If you're saying that his policy platform should have been a little bit more left-leaning, I mean, like who? Like Bernie Sanders? Because Bernie didn't even make it out of the Democratic primary. Why would we expect that a more left-leaning platform would have had any more success in modern-day politics than Joe Biden's platform?
I'm only referring to the platform that he ran on and the platform that he himself committed to passing. As far as more left or more center or more right, I don't think it's very relevant. It's what did Biden promise, and why is he able to unable to fulfill his own promise? As far as the infrastructure bill is concerned, the initial target was what, 3.2 trillion, and it shaved down to what, 1.2? I mean, I don't think the infrastructure bill is any accomplishment whatsoever. This is the this is the regular type of upkeep that any type of modern advanced government should be doing with regard to its infrastructure. As far as like the sweeping changes that would be necessary to actually upgrade our infrastructure for the new era, it fell short. I don't see why a country who's a modern, advanced, and developed country, supposedly the wealthiest country in the world, why is it an accomplishment that we have sort of upgraded our infrastructure or at least replaced the old decaying? Why did we have decaying and rotting infrastructure in the first place, I think, is a better question.
I think that a lot of the criticisms you seem to have of Biden are actually criticisms, I think, of the American public. I don't know how I'm supposed to get. So Biden is the leader right now of probably historically one of the most divided Americas that have existed since probably the Civil War. You have a lot of criticisms in regards to, like, why haven't we done this or why haven't we done that? Well, the American public is super divided on it. Trump said that he was going to pass an infrastructure bill. He wasn't able to do it. Biden said he was going to pass an infrastructure bill. He was able to do it. Now, the original figure, which I think Bernie actually had one that was north of $6 trillion, obviously didn't get passed. It had to be negotiated down, but something was passed. And what was passed was the largest infrastructure bill by dollar amount in U.S. history. Could it have been more? I don't know. I'm just not seeing the ability of Biden to navigate the Senate as it exists right now in a way that would have allowed him to do more. You talk about, like, why isn't he able to bring certain people in line? You mentioned that Biden seems to have a unique challenge with Sinema or with Manchin. I don't think it's very unique at all. I think we were one vote away from the public option under Obama because of Lieberman in the Senate. That was just one senator. And then I think both Bush and Trump had a lot of problems getting stuff done in the House because of the Freedom Caucus. There have historically always been these like groups of people that have existed inside of the Senate or the House that form kind of their own little caucuses that can be a roadblock to whatever leader is in office. I don't think that Biden is facing a unique pressure right now that nobody else ever has. And again, especially when you literally have a 0-1 vote lead by the tiebreaker in the Senate, I don't think it's that crazy that one or two more moderate senators could pose a significant hurdle to getting legislation passed. I don't think that's a fair critique of Biden.
So why can't Biden, at the very least, publicly and vigorously denounce and support alternative candidates to people like Manchin and Sinema?
Because Manchin is probably the only Democrat that's going to win in West Virginia. Like, other progressives and other moderates have tried to run, and they've gotten destroyed. As far as Sinema goes, it's hard to know if another Democrat could win Sinema's seat. Now, I know people like to point over and look at Mark Kelly, but the types of voters that voted for Sinema and the types of voters that voted for Mark Kelly are far different. And right now, it's questionable, with his approval rating, if Mark Kelly's even going to win re-election. So I think that people have this fantasy, this delusion that the president can come and just shift all of this weight onto pressuring people in these very at-risk seats. But the reality is they know that they're not going to be outcompeted by another Democrat. You know, the only thing that they might do is they might just switch to become actual Republicans. They might just switch party. But they're not actually going to be threatened by another Democratic candidate in either of these areas.
Okay, so to me that sounds like the reason why Biden can't do it is because he's not actually an authentically popular president, and that the only thing he was able to run on was basically that he wasn't Trump. He didn't actually create or rally a movement behind him that will support him and execute his sweeping vision, the one that he promised on the campaign trail, and which was used to at least garner some votes for people who just not only wanted to oppose Trump, but believed in this, all of these promises Biden was going to make. Why did he make those promises in the first place then? If what the actual positive platform he ran on is not popular enough among the American people, that it didn't create a movement that can be used against the old guard, I mean, what does that say about Biden's presidency and his significance as a leader overall?
I mean, we can argue all day what it says about him, but I think it says more about the American public than it does about a particular leader. We can say that Biden isn't authentically popular, but he got more votes than any president in U.S. history. Now, we can argue that's just because Trump galvanized the other side, that Trump made people go out and vote against him. I guess if you want to argue that, we can. But I don't think that Biden's issue with passing his platform has to do directly with the popularity of his platform. I think that most of the pushback that he's facing is going to be in places where there are Republican strongholds, so in West Virginia or Arizona with Manchin or Sinema. I don't think it's fair to say that Biden's platform isn't popular among Democrats when the main obstacles that we face are in the Senate that are right now overrepresented with Republican senators and then moderate Democrats. I don't think that the average Democratic voter is going to be against, you know, expanding Medicare and Medicaid, or is going to be against an increase in the minimum wage, or is going to be against the added protections of unions, or is going to be against things like mask mandates or vaccine mandates for OSHA. I think that all of the opposition that we're seeing here comes from the Republican establishment, and I don't really know if it's fair to blame Biden for that.
Well, if you look at people like, for example, FDR and other leaders, they were also facing voters who traditionally voted one way. And for some reason, presidents like that, or candidates like that, were able to address the reasons why people would vote that other way, and he was able to turn them. What has Biden done as a president and as a leader to address the reasons why, for example, people in West Virginia would lean more conservative? Now, we know that the people in West Virginia, I mean, economically at least, it is within their interests to support a program and policies that one may call, I don't like the term, progressive, right? They want government to help in the economy and so on and so on. Why is it that they vote, in your view, conservative in the first place, and why can't Biden address this contradiction?
So one of the big dividing issues right now between left and right has to do with energy. And my understanding is that in West Virginia, they're pretty old or conservative in regards to their views of the utilization of fossil fuels, especially coal, I think. So on the left, you have a lot of pressure to modernize your energy systems. You've got a lot of pressure to cancel pipelines, three major ones, the Keystone Pipeline, there were two other ones, have already been canceled in the United States because of mounting political pressures. And then you've got Biden also saying things like, I think we stopped all new drilling on federally owned lands. When you've got a lot of push from your party internally to kind of like curb the fossil fuel exploitation and to kind of move in a greener direction, and then you've got some states that still have a lot of their economy based around or centered around fossil fuels, that's a pretty difficult position for Biden to navigate. I don't know what your suggestion there is. Well, this is an easy way to alleviate all of these people's concerns. You could argue that it's through stimulus. He's already done that in multiple ways, multiple times. I don't know how else Biden is supposed to appeal to those voters.
Well, if I recall correctly, Biden's party, the Democratic Party, I forget who said this precisely, but I think it's maybe Hillary. If I recall correctly, the record is that they told the people, for example, of West Virginia and these coal miners, that the alternative that they're going to present them upon cracking down upon this fossil fuel industries is that the suggestion they gave is that they should learn to code. So how has Biden alleviated these concerns among the workers of West Virginia that they are going to have suitable replacements for these old jobs?
I don't know what the federal government can do in terms of replacing those jobs. What do you think? What is something the federal government can do?
There is precedent for the federal government to provide people with jobs when there were none. I mean, during the New Deal, what was it called? It was something civilian job. There were overreaching federal projects to provide people with work to do. There's examples and precedents of countries addressing systematic and industrial changes to provide people new sources of income and new types of jobs. So this is something that is within the realm of possibility for the federal government to do. I mean, I don't see why that's so outlandish.
So I'll ask again. So, like, what are examples? Like, I don't know what the federal government is supposed to do for all of the fossil fuel workers in West Virginia. Are they all supposed to become mailmen, or?
No. I mean, first of all, there is a lot of work, for instance, that needs to be done as far as actually building real infrastructure in this country.
Which we did with an infrastructure bill, hopefully, right?
Well, the point is, there's work to be done, right? There's definitely work to be done. That these people can do as an alternative. I mean, there's new industries that are emerging. There's new sectors the government's job is to guide people who lost their entire way of living and livelihood, having been the very source of trying to crack down on the old kind.
Do you think the government should be like kind of guiding these people into newer, more modern jobs?
Yes.
So would you say the government should tell these people that they need to learn to code?
Absolutely not.
Because that's exactly kind of what you're just saying, right? People that are
That is not a type of job that is befitting of the skill set that those people already have. People have a skill set that is already from the heavy industries, and certainly heavy industry in general is not something that is being outmoded. Apparently, the old fossil fuel industry is being outmoded. So the government's responsibility would to be to guide these people to have new jobs that are befitting of the skill set that they already have.
Who is to say that any jobs that you're picking up at or any jobs that you're learning at like a fossil fuel plant is going to carry over to jobs related to green energy?
It doesn't have to even relate to energy specifically.
Okay, then we go back to my central question what jobs are these people supposed to do?
There's a multitude of possibilities. America's manufacturing sector has been on the decline for decades. It could be a renewed form of manufacturing. I mean, there's multiple things. There's multiple forms of heavy industry. I just mentioned infrastructure. Probably West Virginia, of all states, is a state that needs a lot of good and up-to-date infrastructure. I mean, from engineers to...
So, you're not going to retrain people that work at coal plants to be engineers, right?
Yeah, but it's certainly going to be more possible to train them to do work with their hands than to say something. I mean, the whole learn to code meme just reflected how out of touch the Democratic Party was with these people and their way of life. I mean,
I think that your comments, I think illustrate how out of touch I think you are. When you say these people can work with their hands so we can retrain them in manufacturing. We still manufacture in the United States, but the manufacturers today are engineers and people that maintain robots. It's not people that are in factories
building.
That's not
true.
It absolutely is true.
That is not
true. The expansions to manufacturing and the specialization of manufacturing in the United States has come off of the back of modernizing capital and modernizing the automation that we have for these industries. It's not people that are in factories anymore building cars. This is why traditionally all of our big manufacturing cities, all of these states in the Rust Belt, all of our Detroits have kind of fallen, and those jobs don't exist anymore because the people working those jobs are now white-collar workers with college degrees and not people in factories actually building
machines. A large
proportion
of manufacturing is still done in the traditional way, not just by engineers and specialists. Now, the reason you don't see that a lot in the United States is because those jobs have shipped overseas. But it's not manufacturing in general, it's the type of manufacturing that currently prevails in the United States as a result of the trade agreements like NAFTA and so on decades ago.
Despite being wrong on all this, I'm going to grant you all of this, and we'll say that it is possible that these people can be magically retrained to work these manufacturing jobs that don't currently even
which
have
which is
the,
one example.
The only example you give me. But let's assume all of that was true somehow. In a Senate where you're divided 50-50, how is Biden supposed to bring together that Senate to, one, agree that we need to cut fossil fuels, which is already something that's highly contentious in the United States, and then, two, allocate the federal funding necessary, that's probably going to be in the tens or hundreds of billions of dollars, to employ or retrain all of these people for other jobs? How would a program like that possibly pass in the Senate?
We're going in a circle. The entire reason why I raised this was because we have to ask the question, why are voters in West Virginia voting against their own interests? You told me because they're attached to these old type of jobs, which the Biden administration is against. Now, you seem to be fixated on the question of manufacturing as the only alternative. I just named it as an example. There's other examples. There is still a mining industry that's going to persist regardless of the end of fossil fuels. I mean, there's a ton of examples that you could probably name. You can go into the nitty-gritty of each and every one, but a reasonable person would concede that there are alternatives. In general, there are alternatives that befit those people's skill set. I don't think that's such an outlandish and unreasonable claim.
The idea that you can take people that are in their 40s or 50s that have been working in certain sectors for their entire life and just have them hop over and do something equivalent that's going to make them the same amount of money is probably not ever going to happen.
Why not?
Because historically, we tried to do this after NAFTA. When NAFTA happened, our manufacturing specialized in the United States, and we shipped a lot of our supply chain south to Mexico, some things north to Canada. And what happened was, is we tried to spend money in the United States retraining some workers to do other jobs. And I think by the end of most of those experiments, what we realized was, hey, spending money retraining is actually a huge waste of time. It would have been better to just literally cut people checks from the government and just pay them not to
which
work.
Which other jobs?
What do you mean, which other jobs?
Which other jobs were they retraining people
to? I don't know specifically what they were retraining to, but I know that NAFTA had provisions.
There was no major effort on part of the U.S.
government. The administration literally had huge programs set up to retrain workers. There are at least two huge studies published in the
retrain them to do what?
National Bureau of Economic Research. I don't know the specific jobs they were retraining them to. All I know is that the money spent to retrain people, and this should be pretty obvious, if you've got a guy that's worked in a certain industry for 20 or 30 years, retraining them to do another job in a few months or 6 months or even a year or two is going to be really difficult to do. And at some point after NAFTA, people decided, you know what, for retraining a lot of these people, they would have been better off just getting checks from the government instead of the massive amount of money they were spending trying to retrain them.
The problem is treating it as a matter of respecialization, when the whole point of these jobs that were shipped overseas was that these were general jobs that the average Joe, for example, the baby boomers, they could just go and do right out of high school. So the question isn't, do you retrain them to learn to code or these overly specialized professions? The question is, how will the government help establish a new type of standard job?
That's not the world we live in anymore. Those jobs don't exist.
Why not?
because capital has gotten, you should believe this, as a leftist, right? Capital has gotten more efficient, has been able to deliver higher productivity per employee, because you only need one person to run 10 robots than 10 employees to build a car.
This is all relative. You could say that, you could make the
it's
same.
It's relative to the rest of the world.
No. Historically speaking, it's relative. You could have made the same exact argument before World War II or before the New Deal, because at that point, you did have a similar kind of situation where there wasn't really a standard middle class type of job. On the one hand, you had this really proletarianized population. On the other hand, you had a ruling class. The standard type of job that I'm talking about is something that only really arose as the standard for the advanced capitalist countries after World War II.
I don't know.
As a result...
Okay, hold on. We have to engage in a huge level of self-delusion if we're going to believe that today capital hasn't become so much more efficient and productive that a single piece of capital per unit is far more productive than it was in the past and is massively outproductive compared to workers of the past.
This is comparable to like the mechanization of agriculture. It's all relative.
Wait, hold on. When you say it's all relative, what do you mean by that? That's an empty
increasing
statement.
Automation does not actually lead to the abandonment of the need for physical labor. What it can lead to is new types of labor emerging, as well as reduction of the overall working day, working week, and so on and so on.
Which I'm
100% in favor of.
New labor emerging is true, and that's happened, but that's why it's become increasingly important to educate our economy, because the new labor that's emerging has been the people that are maintaining or servicing those machines. That's the new labor.
No, it's not. What is an essential worker in 2021? An essential worker isn't just people attending to machines. An essential worker is someone who attends to the shit that we're going to need when the apocalypse happens, for instance, right? The people who are going to still need to be delivering packages, the people who are still going to be unloading trucks, the people who are still going to be at shipping centers, and so there are some jobs that we haven't replaced yet.
But if I were to point to, like, say, agriculture, are we going to say that there's ever going to be a time when a field of people can make a competitive wage competing against a single John Deere machine?
Then how do you explain the continued prevalence of low-skill migrant agriculture in the United States up to this point?
I don't have to explain anything. The trend is explained in my favor. One of the largest growing reasons for wealth inequality today in the United States is the four-year degree. It is becoming increasingly important in American society and in the world at large that everybody needs to have a four-year degree because the level of education is necessary to compete in today's economy. You can talk to me until you're blue in the face about how there are people that unload trucks, yeah, but the problem is the demand for that labor is decreasing as more stuff becomes automated, and it's becoming increasingly necessary to go to college to get an education to be competitive in today's workforce.
Wait, but that didn't answer my question. You mentioned how could you compete with a John Deere machine in agriculture, but the use of physical labor is still extremely prevalent in the United States up to this point. Agriculture is far from being fully or even wholly mechanized in the United States.
Do you think there are more or less machines today that have replaced physical laborers? More or less?
More or less compared to when? I actually don't know.
Compared to the past.
I don't know today
if there are more or less machines.
No, because low-skill migrant labor is so important for the agricultural sector in the United States that even as a matter of an inference, I literally could not tell you.
What's the next thing, I guess, that you think that Biden could improve on?
Biden's stimulus relief package, the American Rescue Plan, and how this has cut childhood poverty in half, and how Biden has done so much to help working families and so on. Well, it's curious to me because how would you address the overwhelming unpopularity of the child tax credit? Its approval rating is in the 50s among America's people. Only 15% of recipients of the childhood tax credit said it has helped them significantly, whereas 64% said it helped them a little bit. As far as people polled about what's the most important part of the Build Back Better program, Only 14% said that it was going to be important. Now, I don't want to throw all these statistics at you, but we have to face the fact that inflation and rising prices probably have offset whatever accomplishment you think the childhood tax credit has made.
So I heard you quote me why so many people don't like the child tax credit, but then you point that it's got about a 60%, at least slightly positive view of it.
It helped them a little.
It did help a little, but I mean, that's about all you can expect. It wasn't UBI. It's not a $1,000 a month check that people are getting cut. But it still has a slightly favorable view.
But,
and for those that are getting the extra $200 a month or whatever, I'm sure it helps a bit. It's not going to be the best thing in the world, or it's not going to be like solving all of their financial problems. And then inflation is a real issue right now. But I don't know how inflation is Biden's fault, and I'm not even sure at this point what Biden can do to address inflation.
Well, this is another thing. This is a constant theme we're constantly getting with regard to making excuses for Biden. So on the campaign trail, Biden will make, I know this was before the inflation crisis, but Biden would make bold and sweeping claims like, we're going to shut down the virus. And he would say things like, we're never going to raise the white flag. And now, more than 600,000 deaths later, apparently it's out of his hands. There's absolutely nothing he can do. My issue is the stark contrast between the level of power being projected on the campaign trail and the sobering reality of the fact that the president does not actually have, supposedly, so much power.
So when we were
furthermore, what steps has Biden taken to address the inflation crisis? He has actually engaged in record spending. And I'm not an expert in economics, but it is my inclination that if you keep printing money and spending shit, inflation, you're going to make inflation worse, right? So
if you're going to seriously sit here to argue that the president on the campaign trail, was more boisterous or seemed more bombastic or was making bigger promises than what he could deliver in the White House, that's unfortunately going to be true of literally every single president in U.S. history. What I'm comparing Biden to is what other actions could he have taken once he got into office rather than what did he say on the campaign trail versus what he did now, unless he's actually completely flipped or 180'd on some things. So, for instance, I think it's fair to criticize Obama when I believe he said on the campaign trail he's going to shut down Guantanamo Bay, and then he gets in office and he more or less does nothing about it for 8 years for whatever reason. I think that's a fair criticism. In terms of like what I can credit a president for versus what I'm going to attack a president for, I try to say like, well, what can a president influence? So the reason why I brought up things like the child tax credit, why I brought up things like the infrastructure plan or the second round of stimulus, because these are things that are within the direct control or purview or influence, at least, of the president of the United States. Now, when we look at something like inflation, which has many causes and is an incredibly complicated thing in society, I don't know what Biden himself could do to combat inflation. We have the Federal Reserve that can increase interest rates, which I believe they're already talking about doing. But the Federal Reserve exists independent of the president. The only other really thing that Biden could influence there is maybe cooling down the demand side of the economy, getting rid of the stimulus. But it seems like that same stimulus has been pretty important to keeping Americans afloat, whether we're talking about the unemployment insurance, the actual stimulus checks, the payment protection program. Like, these things are important things that Americans have probably needed. I don't know if it would be fair to say that Biden should have just cut all of that and then seen what happened. I believe we tried that during the Great Depression. I don't think it worked very well. If you think that there's something that Biden should be doing right now to address inflation, which in my understanding is caused by a historic shortage of supply chain related labor across the world because of sickness and disease, and is caused by a historic shift in the types of spending that Americans are engaging in, where we're spending more and more and more money on goods and services, which is why we've seen things like the cost of goods on Amazon increase, but we're not really spending as much on services, which is why you don't see things like haircuts or airplane tickets increase as much. What are things that Biden could be doing to address the, I guess, supply chain crisis that would make these things better? How can Biden curb inflation?
So when in the history of the United States have we faced such an overwhelming national crisis, an economic crisis, and the response we're being given as far as the inaction, ineptitude, and powerlessness of the president is, well, he can't do anything, it's out of his hands. I mean, you say that all presidents are more boisterous on the campaign trail, which is true, but the great presidents in the history of the United States, and great, I say, in the sense of what they were able to accomplish, They actually did execute very bold, sweeping visions upon reaching office. And I keep bringing up FDR because the crisis we're facing now is proportionate to the crisis he came into office trying to face. So that's why I'm holding Biden to that standard. But even if you talk about other presidents, Eisenhower, JFK, or Lyndon Johnson, and so on and so on, you can see the stark contrast. These were presidents who didn't just pass a little bit of some legislation upon getting power. They were able to execute bold, sweeping visions with decisive leadership befitting of the office of the president of the supposedly the most powerful country on earth. I mean, Biden's weakness and ineptitude in the face of this crisis, in general, speaks to his failure as a president.
Okay. None of that rambling had anything to do with my question, so I'm going to ask again. What can Biden do to curb inflation?
Am I the president?
Nope, but you're critiquing the president.
The job of the president is to gather around of people who know how to do that kind of shit and fix it. I'm not the president, so I'm not sure why you're asking me, like, exactly what Biden has to do to address the inflation crisis.
So if you don't know the answer, do you think it might be possible that the issues that are causing inflation are outside of Biden's control?
No, I refuse to believe that the president of the United States can basically do nothing to address the inflation crisis.
So to understand your point, you're saying that you know that he can do something to address the issue, but you don't know what he can do to address the issue.
I don't know
idea.
Exactly what he
you,
can
no,
do.
No, not exactly. You don't even have a general idea of what he can do.
No, I think I have a general idea of what he could do.
What's a general idea of how Biden can address inflation?
Typically, the way that you address things like inflation is you focus on building the real economy. So there's a distinction between real economy and fictitious or virtual economy. And Biden does not, following a line of neoliberal presidents, he doesn't actually recognize that distinction. He collapses everything into... So, for example, the way Biden has responded to the crisis we're facing is he's just throwing money at shit, right? But has he actually addressed the underlying source of the value of money, which lies in the real economy? So Biden has done nothing to actually bolster our real economy.
Is the real economy, and what can Biden do to bolster the
real
economy?
The real economy is more or less our heavy industries.
So what does Biden need to do to bolster our real economy?
Biden needs to promote new heavy industries at the expense of the old ones that the monopolies who are beholden to the special interests that lobby for him and fund his party, to which his party is beholden to. He has to do things that come at the expense of the established special interests, including Wall Street and the financial capitalist class, which benefits from the decay and the rotting of America's real economy.
So you want Biden to essentially create from thin air, with a 50-vote to 50-vote, slimmest majority possible in the Senate, a whole new heavy industry that on its own wouldn't even necessarily address any of the issues of inflation. I don't understand how, this is like literally impossible. You can keep comparing him to FDR all you want, but you can go and look at the majorities that FDR had in the Senate and the House. It's a totally different legislative arena to try to compare the two. Oh, hold on. And then the idea that none of these things seem to have anything to do with inflation. You're talking about promoting new heavy industry. What new heavy industry that's still gonna have to ship goods from overseas over to the United States? That's still gonna apply upward pressure on prices for goods that are being shipped from overseas? This is literally where all of the pressure is coming from for inflation. I don't understand why you think this would affect, unless you're talking about creating new industries to ship things.
You claim that this is the source, but when you have a broader picture of the source of inflation, it's clearly a crisis of the U.S. dollar that's coming to a fore. That has been predicted for many, many decades by people who recognize that the currency, the United States currency, isn't backed by anything real. So we don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of that because it's a distraction, but your claim of knowing the complete cause of the inflation is questionable. Now, as far as Biden creating heavy industry from thin air, that's not what I said. He has done nothing to take action like other governments in the world to promote these new types of industries and promote the real economy at the expense of our corrupt ruling class. And if Biden positioned himself in that way, he would have a popular mandate even more powerful than Trump's. He would be able to get these Democrats to fall in line. I mean, if Biden were to position himself against the corrupt status quo that is preventing Democratic leadership from pursuing bold, sweeping changes like this, there's no doubt that the problem he's currently facing would not be a problem.
Why do
people
you think
like Manchin would not be elected in the first place? And these old Democrats in this contested territory, there would be no threat of the Republicans. The Republicans win because they're populists, right? So Biden does not have a popular mandate. He doesn't have a popular base for his presidency and his support. That's why he can't do it.
So why do we think that the reason that Biden can't pass an agenda is because of a corrupt status quo and not just a legitimate division in Americans when it comes to their future vision of the country?
Because this corrupt status quo has rigged a vicious game of politicians being able to shift the blame for their incompetence and inaction to the constituency and to the voters. So, for example, when Democrats are unable to get things passed, conveniently, they are protecting this entrenched status quo and this corrupt ruling class, all because, well, voters in West Virginia are a little bit more conservative, and that's why Manchin can't afford to vote for these bold, sweeping changes. It's a game of shifting blame to the constituency, when in reality, it's only the corrupt ruling class that is benefiting, not the constituency.
Yeah, so everything you just said is just...
All
of this is nonsense, so right?
You blame the constituency, but the only people who are the ruling class. The constituency doesn't benefit.
Then why are they voting the way they do? Why do they continue to support
Republicans
in office?
Because they have been duped to vote against their own interests in a way that benefits the ruling class.
Okay, so in the worldview that you've constructed, people either agree with you or they disagree with you because they've been duped by the ruling class. There's no other alternative. There's no room that maybe there might be genuine disagreement among Americans for how the country should be ran.
Okay, have these Americans who supposedly authentically disagree, they're not being duped or manipulated whatsoever by the ruling class and by these politicians, how have they benefited from these things that they supposedly believe in?
Well, if they're Republicans, they benefited because their social agenda has been pushed. So, for instance, things like trying to fight against
abortion. Let's talk about meat and potatoes, things that actually affect people's lives.
You can talk about meat and potato things that actually affect people's lives because as a Marxist, it's the only thing you care about. But the reality is there's a lot of single-issue voters in the United States over things like evangelical issues.
As a Marxist.
Over things like social issues,
okay,
over things like abortion, over things like, is my president supporting an LGBTQ agenda or whatever? For a lot of Americans, they're a single issue vote. I'm trying to answer your question, okay? There are a lot of Americans that do vote a lot on social issues. They're very important to some Americans. If you want to talk about just meat and potato issues, then we need look no further than West Virginia, where you've got a ton of coal workers that are looking at a Democratic Party that has been presiding over the shutdown of three massive pipelines or pipeline expansions in the United States and that are promising to renew all of our energy sectors into green new energy. And these fossil fuel workers are looking at that potential revitalization of the energy sector, and all they're seeing is their jobs being threatened. That's why you've got the largest conglomerate of unions in the United States, the AFL-CIO, has even come out against things like the Green New Deal because they're worried about the future of their jobs. So to try and say that, like, oh, well, look at the meat and potatoes issues, they're all just dumb, brainwashed Americans, that's not necessarily true. I think there are legitimate reasons for workers in some of these industries to be concerned about the future of their jobs when you've got Democrats that are getting a lot of pressure, internal and external, to revitalize the entire fossil fuel sector and make it green in a way that might not be compatible with the workers that already exist in that sector.
Okay, so the Democrats are cracking down on these old industries, supposedly. Supposedly they're cracking down, right? We're supposed to believe that.
Pipelines not canceled?
Hey, don't interrupt me. I didn't interrupt you.
You did interrupt
doing
me like
this.
Seven times.
Yeah, yeah, but I let you talk eventually.
Yeah, after I shut
so it's
it
my
enough.
Turn now.
Yeah.
So they did this because they're supposedly acting on behalf of what's in everyone's interests. But if they can't reconcile this with what's in the immediate interests of these West Virginia workers, why is that? Why can't Democrats provide a suitable alternative for the, we're gonna go in circles again, for these West Virginia workers when they're pursuing this agenda? Because they're remaining entrapped in this vicious cycle where they're leaving these people with no option but to back the conservative fossil fuel industries because they have no alternative, right? And that conveniently just so happens to benefit the sources of revenue, significant sources of revenue, for the Democratic Party. So it's like in the form of these industries and this ruling class that benefits from it. So this is a good example, actually, of what I'm talking about, of the vicious cycle of laying the blame on the constituency. Now, as far as this as a Marxist stuff, as a Marxist, all I would say about these social issues and these ideological issues that seem to divide Americans is that they're just an interface for meat and potatoes issues. I mean, social issues are not things people care about in and of themselves. They are signifiers of social differences. When you're, for example, coming out against, this environmental bullshit, you're signaling to other people that you're part of some kind of same social group and social class. When you're more pro-LGBT or more pro-progressive on social issues, you're basically signaling oftentimes, and this actually can be proven directly, socially, that you represent the urban, educated, professional managerials and so on and so on. Not to say that those issues are inherently tied to those classes, but that's just the point. These are signifiers of social differences that are based on meat and potatoes. And this can actually be proven based on how inconsistent people are attached to them, and how you can almost entirely pin why people attribute significance to them on the basis of basically social signifiers.
So the problem that you're running into is you're trying to say that Democrats can't get through huge roadblock X because they haven't given us all of solutions Y. But the issue is a lot of Americans don't even agree that X is an issue. This is the problem that you're running into. You keep trying to say, well, Democrats can't give an alternative to what these fossil fuel workers are going to be doing once those industries are shut down. That's absolutely not true. The Green New Deal basically outlines the idea behind federal jobs guarantees and all sorts of other things to try to give these people jobs afterwards when those industries get shut down. But the problem is something like the Green New Deal is incredibly controversial, even within the Democratic Party. You're trying to say that because Democrats can't give you an ideal utopian world for these workers after this huge change goes through, they have no solutions to anything. But the reality is a lot of people in America don't even agree that change needs to go through. Half of America probably doesn't think that climate change is a real thing that's driven by man-made causes. When you have that big of a division in genuine American opinion, genuine voter opinion, the idea that these people are supposed to come together on a solution to a problem they don't even agree exists is ludicrous. And then to take that a step further and to get conspiratorial and to blame it as like big business and big interest and try to say that that's the reason why lawmakers in Congress are opposed to it, when you can find a genuine division in American people over these issues, is just nonsense.
So you're saying Americans agree it's not even an issue, but what happens when the workers of West Virginia are faced with the crisis of the fact that things cannot go on as they used to? Is this an inevitability, or is this only because the Democrats are going to arbitrarily crack down on these industries? Isn't there sources within the market itself that are leading to a decline of the viability of these industries, the fossil fuel industry?
Can you say that? I don't understand what you just said.
Isn't the fossil fuel industry declining based not only on the political factors, but also based on the market factors?
It's starting to, yeah, with a lot of government incentivization, yeah, on
sure.
The other end.
So when it comes to what you're saying, well, they don't even see it as an issue. Do you agree it objectively is an issue, whether they supposedly see that or not?
Yeah, well,
is it an issue for them and for their lives?
I mean, I would say that it is, of course.
Okay, so if it objectively is an issue for them and their lives, then it is reasonable to assume you can somehow persuade them to see that, or at least
explain that to them
in a way that makes sense to them.
Then go on the campaign trail and explain to all the people in West Virginia or in any other fossil fuel heavy state that, hey,
maybe
green energy is coming and it's going to be good for you guys.
Well, that's precisely what Joe Biden was supposed to do, and he failed utterly in doing that, which is why I view him as having a disastrous record up to this point.
Okay, so one of Joe Biden's principal failures was that he wasn't able to convince the Republican Party that fossil fuels would become outdated.
Don't say the Republican Party. We're talking about the on-the-ground, working-class constituents of Joe Manchin and other potentially Republican
On the ground, working-class people don't care about climate change.
Well, does it affect their lives objectively?
It might in the future, but right now, for somebody earlier that was talking about meat and potatoes issues, are you really going to try to tell me that an average like 9-to-5 worker is coming home thinking about CO2 levels in the ocean?
You just said that as far as that's concerned, it is starting to objectively affect their lives because of market signals not necessarily because of some abstract agenda about climate change.
The market signals might have gotten there on a broader state level for some energy programs in some southern states so far, but that doesn't mean that the average American is feeling the pressure of climate change such that they're ready to take action.
Not climate change, but a shift in the use of
energy. Even a shift in energy. I think most of the major shifts in energy have come. I think California is a big state, maybe Arizona and Nevada. I think it's these southern states that have like a lot of sunlight in them are the ones that are able to most adapt to these solar panel basically things. I know in the Midwest, I think they've got a lot of wind energy, but I don't think this is making up a very high percentage so far of American energy yet. Not enough for people to see a difference.
So what you're basically saying is that the only reason workers in West Virginia would ever see, the only reason for why this issue is going to affect them is because of climate change in the future.
It might be prices as well, but if you're going to talk about how eventually market signals are going to move an economy...
I'm saying they already are. I mean,
they are starting
the price
to, but
of gas,
then all you're going to have then is in 5 years or 10 years, when that starts to happen more and more, you're just going to have an entire fossil fuel industry whose workers are now out of work. So I don't understand what this is supposed to solve.
So the whole point is, why can this not somehow be conveyed or made sensible to the people of West Virginia themselves? Have the Democrats done a good job of doing that?
Because all of these issues are highly divisive issues in the American political economy.
So you're saying they don't have the trust of those people?
Sure. It might be that they don't trust the government. It might be they don't trust the Democrats. It's probably a wide variety of reasons why people don't believe in certain things.
But when I ask, so when you ask me a question about what can be done, and I say there's a wide variety of possibilities, I can only tell you that. But when I ask you, it's like, do you not see the double standard here? You can't give me an example.
No. Hold on. I'm asking you, what can Joe Biden do
Give me an example why the Democrats can't convince the workers of West Virginia.
So I'm asking you, what can Biden do to solve or alleviate inflation? That was a question I asked, because you said he should be doing more to solve or alleviate inflation. And you're asking me, why do Americans have opinions about a particular large social issue or large economic issue? These two questions are very different from one another.
Well, if they were floating heads in the air, maybe it would, but the question is, why do these opinions contrast so greatly with what you would probably agree with, or maybe you don't agree that there's such a thing, as their objective interests?
It depends on what constituency you're talking about. So for some people, there might be social interests that override an economic interest. For other people, they might genuinely be voting against their own economic interests, but they're not necessarily aware of it. For other groups of people, say rural versus city people,
we're talking
there
about
might
the people
be greater
of West
economic...
Virginia.
We're talking about who?
The people of West Virginia.
Even within West Virginia, there's probably some divide amongst rural or city voters. I don't know exactly
the
what
workers
all the
of
values.
West Virginia in the oil industry right now.
Okay, so what is your specific question? You're asking me why aren't they on board with green energy?
Why is it, if it is supposedly objectively in their interest to be on board with the government's agenda to crack down on the fossil fuel industry, why are they opposed to it?
My guess is they're probably opposed to it is because there's a ton of historic industry and there's probably generations of workers that have all worked in these areas and they don't want to see those areas threatened. That'd be my guess.
But it is objectively in their interests, according to you?
I don't like using the word objectively.
So
but
no,
I mean,
you
I would
don't
say
agree
it probably is, yeah. But people don't
generally
think...
But you think it's just subjectively and it's not objective?
I would argue that objectively it is, but people are pretty short-term with their approach to things. They don't really think long-term generally. People are going to do what is in their best interest in the short-term and generally maximize for that, rather than thinking like, well, maybe if I sacrifice my jobs today, maybe my children's future will be better. That's not generally what people think, because they don't know if in the future things are going to be better for them.
So
especially
if
the government doesn't have a great track record of taking care of people that have been displaced in certain industries.
So here's a question for you. If the former President Trump went to the people of West Virginia and said, hey guys, listen, we gotta pack it up. This type of industry is not working anymore. We're gonna get you new jobs. Do you think they would be more trusting of former President Trump than they would have of Mr. Joe Biden?
I don't know. Maybe, maybe not.
I mean, answer what you really think. Would they be more
Probably
trusting?
Probably not. No, I don't think so. Not around this issue, no.
So when it comes to this, they would be just as much skeptical of Trump as Joe Biden. These diehard MAGA people that are in West Virginia, these workers of West Virginia, you think they wouldn't trust
I have three good examples for this. Trump promised an infrastructure bill. It never came. Trump promised a repeal and replace of health care. It never happened. And Trump is literally telling people to get vaccinated, and he gets booed at his own rallies. No, so when you try to present to me here, Trump is this idealistic idol who people will literally worship and do whatever they say, these MAGA-worshipping Trump people. Like, Americans do certain things, but they're not going to blindly follow a leader into everything when they have contradictory interests to do so. I just gave you three really good examples where it seemed like Trump can rule the United States. I gave you three. Where Trump can rule the United States and get his agenda done. That's not always going to be the case.
No,
if Trump were to come out and say, listen, guys, we're going to get rid of fossil fuels and we're going to go green energy, after that contradicts all of his prior messaging, and he can't even get people to take vaccines, I don't think that people in West Virginia are going to jump on board to put up a whole bunch of solar panels and to axe all of
this
their old factories and turn it into Detroit 2.0. I don't think it's going to happen.
Because that's an issue of signaling. If he said Green New Deal and used this code...
It's not about the word.
It is. It absolutely is about that.
Right now.
It absolutely,
we're on some high levels of copium.
It absolutely is about that. If he were to use these... Democrat political coded words like Green New Deal and stuff, obviously he would be signaling to his constituency.
He could call them American Freedom solar panels, whatever he wanted he still wouldn't get support for
it. Hey, guess what? It's the same when it comes to vaccines, too. The reason he gets booed when it comes to vaccines is because his signaling to his constituency about vaccines isn't very distinguishable from the kind that the mainstream media is giving
him. It absolutely is. He calls it the Trump vaccine.
So what? He still is signaling the same type of message, you have to get vaccinated. That is inherently something that's become politicized. And
you don't think him saying we have to revitalize our energy into green energy isn't something that's been politicized?
He would not word it that way.
Why couldn't he word the vaccine differently? Why do you think he can word that differently, but he couldn't for a vaccine?
He can't for the vaccine right now because the vaccine is inherently politically decisive right now.
Not to push you on a specific, but how do you think Trump could have worded the green energy to be more palatable to the Republican Party?
He would not say green energy because there's no reason to think those are the types of jobs people would have in West Virginia. Green energy is not relevant. What he would say is that this old energy is dying, these corrupt special interests or whatever, we're going to get you brand new shining jobs. So you'd say some shit like that, and I think people would be on board with it.
Okay, maybe. That would have been an interesting world to see, I guess.
You don't think that Trump's constituency would be more... The question is, would they trust him more on this, at least, than Biden? You said no. I think that's ridiculous.
They might trust him a bit more, but it's not going to be enough to get anything done here. Like, he still wasn't even able to get his agenda passed as much as he wanted to in office. I don't know
which agenda?
I named two huge things. He wanted to get an infrastructure plan passed. He wasn't able to do it. He wanted to repeal and place
healthcare. What were the main obstacles to his infrastructure plan?
Getting enough votes in the Senate and the House.
From the Republicans?
Yes, they had majorities in both.
Okay. And which Republicans were an obstacle to Trump?
I don't know the name of every...
They're called the rhinos, right?
Yeah, Trump calls everybody that doesn't vote with him a rhino.
Exactly. So what is happening to those rhinos as they're facing re-election?
I don't know. I haven't followed all of their elections.
Do you think that...
But I'm guessing given that Trump had a way bigger majority in the Senate than what Biden has now in the House, probably all of them aren't replaced. Like,
okay, but how do you think that a lot of them have been replaced?
I don't know. I haven't followed every election. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, do you think it would be reasonable to assume a lot of them have been replaced given the direction of the Republican Party and what it means now?
I have no idea.
Okay. Well, the whole overarching point is Trump named them. He said these are the rhinos who are getting in our way. And he was able to actually signal against them and rally his constituency against them. And now Trump's word, as far as his endorsement of Republicans, has become so decisive. It's an integral part of the
That's
Republican
Party. That's not always
Party.
True, though.
Really?
Look at the special election with Roy Moore. That guy got destroyed, even though Trump literally threw everything he could behind
Hold
him.
Hold on. I didn't say that Trump supporting someone is going to guarantee him they're going
to
win.
Okay, because it sounded like you said almost exactly
Hold on,
that,
no. Because what I'm saying is it seems to me that if Trump does not support a Republican candidate, they're almost guaranteed to lose.
I don't know if that is the case, but I haven't followed like Trump appointed or Trump supported candidates recently.
There has to be only the smallest type of exceptions that get the Republican Party is, would you agree, the party of Trump right now?
I think there's a huge divide right now in the Republican Party over whether or not they're the party of Trump.
Hold on, there's not a divide in the Republican Party so far as its constituency is concerned. There's a divide as far as the old established neoconservative and so on elements within the Republican Party, not within the actual constituency.
If you whether or not you want to call it the party of Trump, we're going to find out in the next election cycle. But to say right now that anybody knows, like, this is a question that's
up in the air. We do know that the Republican Party's overwhelming source of support is the MAGA movement. Without the MAGA movement, there is no Republican Party. What does the Republican Party represent right now except Trump?
I can say that, but there were also a historic amount of Republicans that left the party post January 6th. It's a really complicated question. You can't pretend to say that you understand the entire makeup of how the Republican Party is going to vote in the next set of elections.
The Republicans you're talking about are the suburbanites that were already going over to the Democrats anyway because of the political realignment.
There's an excuse or a reason for everything.
There's a reason for everything. I thought you were the hyper-rationalistic guy who believes...
I'm not hyper-rationalistic, but like when you have a worldview that collapses in every single question,
hold on,
but
so
then you have
according
a cabinet
to you
can give to make it work every single time.
So you're talking about
how Biden could have passed any agenda he wanted to with a 50-50 split of the Senate.
But
then you're saying, well, Trump couldn't do it even with 58 or however
hold
many
on,
Republicans
Destiny.
Because there were rhinos in
Destiny,
the House. Like,
Destiny,
there's an infinite number of excuses
Destiny,
for Trump,
Destiny.
But for Biden, there's no reason why he can't do every single thing
listen,
he wants to with margins that are like 20 or 30 votes less than what FDR had, and you're constantly comparing to him.
Hold on.
There's like an excuse or a reason for every
You just gave a reason for something, therefore it's coping. Destiny, for someone who says every time you give an explanation or reason for something that means you're coping, you literally go on these contrived diatribes with the rapid
speed... you've been rambling like 2x as much as me.
With the rapid speed of Eminem Rap God, trying to like give a multitude of complex explanations for every single possible fucking thing. How could you say that when I give a simple explanation to something, when you... impose a question that this is somehow coping or you always have a reason for something.
Sure.
When you impose a question, I'm going to answer your question.
Okay. So the difference between you and me is I will give a broader narrative, and then when you ask me for explanations about it, I will say I'll support it and I'll support it and I'll support it. When you give a broader narrative, I'll say, this doesn't make sense, that doesn't make sense, and then you have like a caveat or a reason for why. Well, okay, there's an exception here. Oh, there's an exception here.
Let's go back to the meat and potatoes of what I just gave an explanation for and why that was inadequate.
Sure, I think it had to do with whether or not Trump could fundamentally rally Republicans in a certain direction for something, despite the fact that he wasn't able to accomplish much legislatively.
No, it was about why Republicans, as you said, left the party in January 6th.
And you're saying that the people that left weren't true Republicans? So they were
people
that were
going
to switch anyway?
The people that left, because of their social class, and I don't want to be too ideological, but let's just be pragmatic about it, those were the suburbanites that the Democrats had been banking on since the 2018 midterms elections, who were already swaying over to the Democrats.
So both sides... There are more people in American politics that are like more moderate than there are people in the extreme left or the extreme right.
That's not
to
my
try
point.
The people that switch were just people that were towards the center. Anyway, everybody is
as
more towards
a mass,
the center in American
as
politics.
As a mass, Republicans who are disillusioned with Trump are an identifiable mass. There's a consistency as far as their social background is concerned, which is they are the new kind of conservative suburbanites who have been swaying more Democrats. It's not like January 6th happened and all of a sudden you just had a bunch of Republicans going, hold on, I was on board with this whole MAGA thing completely with no mixed feelings, but now this is too far, I'm going to the Democrats. No, those are people who already had mixed feelings and were already flirting with the Democrats. And that's the point I made. And when I gave that point, you said you always seem to have a reason or explanation for everything. Well,
the fact
that Republicans have left because of January 6th does not speak to a real division within the Republican Party. It speaks to the fact that there were elements within the Republican Party who were already, again, because of the political realignment that's happened, going to the Democrats. That was my
point.
Aren't
you just describing a division in a party?
No.
I say there's a division in the party and you go, well, there's not a division in a party. There's just elements of the party that are attempting to realign with the other party. Wouldn't that be
a division in a party? Hold on. There's
a
political realignment and a minority who are already going over to the Democrats left.
Okay. I disagree.
That's not a conflict for the soul of the party. That's a conflict between the Democrats and the Republicans. Within the party itself, there's no real division. What elements within the party are going to be able to challenge Trump and say, hey, everyone who joined the Democrats since January 6th, we're going to change this republic. It's dead in the water. There's no fucking way.
We don't know that yet. That's what everybody is looking forward to. Nobody knows for the next.
So you are seriously entertaining the possibility that there's going to be a new Republican Party led by, I don't know, Lincoln Project.
It's not that there's a new Republican Party. It's that right now, I think there is a legitimate huge division in the Republican Party over how people view Donald Trump. I think there is a large sect of the Republican Party that is still
and
loyal
by division,
to Trump.
Do you mean the actual constituency or these old corrupt politicians?
I mean, the actual voters themselves, are very torn on whether or not they do or do not support Trump. I don't think the vast majority of Republicans are all gung-ho.
All it should take is the soon-to-be president, Jeb Bush, to rally half of this Republican Party.
I never
said
it's going to be Jeb Bush.
Well, it's as ridiculous as what you're saying.
So you think that right now the Republican Party, the majority of the constituents are lockstep behind Trump?
Absolutely.
Then why do they boo him at his rallies when he talks about getting vaccinated?
Because they're even more to the right of Trump right now.
Okay.
There's no division within the Republican Party.
Okay.
Those are people who are even more hardcore Trump than Trump himself.
How can you be more Trump than Trump himself?
You just gave the example, the whole vaccine shit.
Okay.
I mean, if we represent Trump in terms of the division within the Republican Party, do you think the Lincoln Project people are going to boo vaccines? Because those are the only people within the Republican Party who are posing as an alternative to Trump.
I think you've had big figureheads in the Republican media establishment that have been pretty against Trump for the entirety of his election.
Okay, and you talked about January 6th. Do you think that the people who are upset over January 6th are going to be anti-vaccine?
Last question. I'll give you a chance to answer and then we're going to jump into the
Q&A. I don't know what the makeup of the people are that left the Republican Party.
Of course they're not. The people who are upset over January 6th are going to be pro-vaccine because they're going to be more pro-establishment.
There's plenty of questions from the audience. So, if you have any questions, please come on up. If you want to speak into this microphone, this would be the place to do it. And then, in addition, a couple of things. One is we kind of tried to open up this middle area so that there can be kind of like a two-lane kind of road here so that you can walk up this way and also walk down this way. That way you don't have to go over the cords. And then the second thing is we're going to bump the infrared versus Dylan Burns debate up to probably about 1 o'clock is when we're shooting to have that debate, just so we can get everybody to their flights in time. All right, thanks for your patience. Floor is all yours.
Okay, this is a quick question. The debate was titled, Did Biden Deliver Well? And I missed the initial few minutes of it. But what I heard was excuses why Biden did not deliver well, not whether or not he did. So if he delivered well, can you provide some sort of evidence for what he has delivered?
So I think that the child tax credit under the coronavirus relief was good. I think that the stimulus that he gave, the second checks that came when he came into office was good. And I think that the bargaining to get both sides together to pass the infrastructure bill were good. I would say that those are good. Oh, and then pulling out of Afghanistan finally. I would say that those are big accomplishments that Biden himself can take credit for.
Thank you for coming, guys. You both did great. Early on in the debate, this is the vibe I got, and I could be completely wrong about this, but Destiny, you believe that like a president should primarily be focused on like breaking the divide of Congress to get things done that otherwise wouldn't be done? Like Biden is good because he gets things done and passes good policies. And Haas, you believe a president should primarily be focused on being a leader with strong principles that serve as both a guide and representative of the will of the people. Biden is bad because he's out of touch with the people and he does not adequately convince and build trust with the working man. If my analysis is generally correct, can either of you respect why the other might have that criteria, or at least can you try to steel man each other's position?
Criticism of Destiny, in a broad sense, has always been that he doesn't know when to divide political realities between subjective and objective. He treats certain realities as objective and set in stone that actually relate to a subjective political will. So, for example, he'll say, oh, we can't do this because this is what the American people want. But he never poses the question, why do they want this? And I think maybe this is where maybe my Marxism may come in. And I am open to people opposing this, but I think there should be an explanation for why do people vote the way they do or have the opinions that they do. I think there's an underlying reason that's not just a superficial ideological appearance.
That was the steel man version of my argument, so I'll give the steel man version, I guess, of his side. The reality is that the vast majority of people that you see online engage in politics do it as a form of recreation or hobby, and the funnest stuff to engage in are people that are wild on Twitter. At the end of the day, the vast majority of people online that talk about politics don't give a fuck about what's in a bill, about what the government is doing, because most of us are wealthy, most of us don't care anyway, we're isolated from the broader economic issues that face most of working class America, so it's more fun to talk about a president as a leader, as somebody that's really bombastic or awesome on Twitter, than it is to see, well, what kind of legislation does the person actually pass? What kind of measurable improvement does the person actually make in the lives of Americans on the ground? So I think that's why people online that do politics are way more interested in a Twitter version of a president than somebody that's actually passing legislation.
Hello, gentlemen. I know on Super Chat we're usually allowed to say, so I want to thank James again for hosting this. This was a great, since yesterday from today, from participating to the debaters, I really appreciate it. I know this is definitely needed, and I appreciate you. And I wish us good fortune in the future for more debates. Quick question, all political parties just got eliminated. President, Infrared, President, Destiny, what is your first objective? What is your first thing you want to tackle?
Do you want to go first? Or do you want to go first?
The first thing I would tackle, I'm going to have to give you a very broad answer because the question is very broad. But the very first thing I would tackle is the crisis of the American dream and the American way of life. How are we going to reestablish a baseline form of way of life and income similar to the one that was after World War II? So I'm concerned with Americans are losing their way of life. How can we make sense of this chaos and arrive at a new normal, more or less?
If I was God Emperor, are we saying like President President or like God Emperor President? Okay, if I was God Emperor President, I think the three huge things that I would, or the four huge things that I would focus on is, number one is I would destroy all the zoning laws in the United States, because the way that we zone this country is a fucking nightmare. I think that we need to have way more mixed use zoning. I think that that would address so many broader problems in our society. It would help with public transit, it would help with density of cities, it would help with like the cost of housing, it would help with getting labor to the right place. There's so many issues that can be traced back to our atrocious zoning in the United States. I think that healthcare is something that we should be able to provide to all of our citizens. It's something that every other country seems to be able to do. I don't know why we haven't figured that out yet. I would say that guaranteeing education for those that are capable of succeeding in it is probably a good idea, without a ton of debt as well. And then I think that having expansive labor union laws, so maybe bringing back some closed shop states or laws in those states, making it so that people are allowed to form stronger labor unions and bringing back some of the older strike laws, I think would probably be good as well, because it seems like capital's gotten stronger and stronger and stronger, and you haven't seen the same increase in representation on the rights of labor side historically in the United States.
You both did great, so thank you for doing this debate and all that. So my question is for Infrared. You kept bringing up earlier in the debate about how Biden is like a weak leader and he can't convince people to do anything, and that you made references to FDR and Eisenhower. So my question to you is, do you believe that the country is as united as a people as they were under FDR and Eisenhower, and hell, even Bush W? And then I'll just take my question out there.
To me, one of the ways to measure the greatness of a leader is their ability to bring people together in times of great division. Lincoln did this. FDR, in a sense, did this. So to me, that's how I would measure whether it's someone is a good president or a good leader in the first place.
So you think that these leaders brought the country together from a division rather than piggybacking off of a kind of a united against a particular front kind of a situation? Is that what?
Can you clarify what you mean?
So the Great Depression brought the country together in order to address the Great Depression. After World War II, there was this great euphoria in the country about how we just won World War II and we have to rebuild the world because we're last man standing. 9/11 brought the country together under Bush, and a lot of people rallied around the flag.
Why can't the common crisis that we're all facing bring this country together? A good leader should be able to bring the country together in a way that is proportionate to the crisis we face.
What is the common crisis?
That's what I would ask.
The common crisis we're facing, you don't think is a common crisis?
Compared to, like, would you say that Bush was a great leader because he unified us after 9/11?
No, Bush was a great deceiver because, well, we don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of that.
Sure. So what is the unifying crisis right now that we have?
Well, I know you're really allergic to this phrase, but what they're calling it is the Fourth Industrial Revolution. The breakdown of the old traditional American dream and old way of life, and the entrance into a new era, the end of American global hegemony, the rise of a multipolar world order. I mean, all of these things.
Everything you're talking about, do you think the average American working class person is perceiving this?
They are not articulating it on these terms, but it is objectively affecting them.
Okay.
So Haas, what could Biden do in the future to change your opinion of him? And Stephen, what was the worst thing that Biden has done that you may acknowledge?
So as a Marxist, my view of politics is that it is a form of warfare. It's a form of social warfare. So I don't believe politics is just this place where we execute policies in a very neutral way. And you know, that's not how it works. Politics is class warfare. So for me to change my opinion of Biden, he has to position himself differently within the current class warfare dividing the country. He has to position himself against the special interests, the corrupt status quo, the monopolies, and so on and so on, and hedge his bets in the working man. And when he does that, if he does that, he will never do that. To me, he will be an admirable leader.
Do you want me to repeat my question if you
do that? No. Am I allowed to answer? Like, can I answer like Haas does?
You guys are having
what was the worst thing about Biden? So,
what was the worst thing?
I think that Biden's biggest problem so far is I think that he's failed to establish himself in kind of the subjective sense of the working class, such that I don't think that these people are able to kind of tangentially relate to him in a way that intersects with the American system and understands the oppressive forces that Americans face today in society, is what I would say.
So only Destiny can make comedy out of his lack of education. He does the work for me.
That was a very elitist take by Haas. Realistically, I think that Biden's biggest problem is I like vaccines. I think everybody should be vaccinated. But I think that pushing for vaccine mandates via OSHA, even if I think I might agree in principle, I think politically is not a good idea because there's such a divisive issue in the United States. I don't know if it's worth it to expend political capital on that right now. So it's more like a question of political strategy. Not sure 100% how I feel about that at the moment. That would probably be my biggest criticism, yeah.
Hi, for both. I wonder what you think about how much Joe Biden can do when the Republican Party basically ahead of time says they're not going to work with him on anything, and that there seems to be no hope of swinging a Republican senator, for example. It's like just a pass that, well, half the Senate's not going to do anything at all. Let's blame the other half that nothing's getting done.
Yeah, again, it's a vicious cycle of shifting blame to constituents. Biden is the leader of the Democratic Party. He cannot blame the Republicans for anything. He's only responsible for the Democratic Party. If the Democrats are unable to win a majority from the Republicans, that's their fault. If half of the country is voting Republican, you should blame if the Democrats want to blame the Republicans for obstructing their agenda, the Democrats alone are to blame for not being popular enough. Now, one can make the argument that the reason they can't do that is because people are just set in stone with their opinions and beliefs, and that's why they vote Republican. But when you go ahead and just admit that it is actually objectively in people's interests, supposedly, I don't even know if I agree with this, to be on the side of the Democrats, I think it's ridiculous, it's preposterous that they would blame the Republicans. Why have they done a bad job in doing something that should be easy, convincing people to vote on behalf of what is supposedly their objective interests?
All right, so thank you very much, gentlemen. Let's give them a round of applause. Fantastic debate. Really appreciate it, you guys. We're gonna take about a 5-minute break and then we're gonna get started. So thanks so much. Thrilled to have you here and looking forward to the next debate.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.